it's interesting because I think people who went to certain types of universities and came out of a certain frat boy culture used to go into like the capital finance industries of the world. They'd go to Wall Street, right? And you got kind of that real bro frat boy culture on Wall Street. And then something happened about 10, 15 years ago where those same people graduating were going into tech instead because it was viewed as being where the big money, big upside was. And so it made it worse, in my opinion, because a certain type of person who was gravitating towards a certain type of life where it was all about the money you could make out of it, and it kind of made it worse. You saw it in the gaming industry as well. It got really ugly, and it still is really ugly in gaming.
Hi, and welcome to Podcaster Stories. Each episode, we'll have a conversation with podcasters from across the globe and share their story, what motivates them, why they started a show, how they grew the show, and more. We'll also talk about their personal lives and some of the things that have happened that have made them the person they are today. And now here's your host, Danny Brown.
Hi, and welcome to Podcaster Stories, the show that gets to meet the people behind the voices of the shows we listen to. This week, I have Lainey Cameron, who's host of the Best of Women's Fiction podcast, a show that brings you interviews with the best of women's fiction authors. So Lainey, welcome to the show. I really appreciate it. And just to give the listeners a quick heads up, this is our third attempt to get this this interview. So I really appreciate the fact that you've made the time today. So welcome to the show. How about you introduce yourself and your podcast?
Sure. And thanks so much for inviting me, Danny. It's such a thrill to have the chance to chat with you. I love your podcast. It's so fun seeing the diversity of different types of people who put together podcasts. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Lainey Cameron. I am a full-time digital nomad, which means I pick places. My husband and I pick places around the world to live and work. All we need is a really good Wi-Fi signal wherever we are. Obviously, we can talk about the pandemic's put a little bit of a problem into that. We had to make some different choices for the last year, but we're looking forward to getting back to our nomadic lifestyle, hopefully starting around October. That's our cross fingers hope. And I'm a full-time author. I write women's fiction, so books that are mostly enjoyed by women with tend to be kind of heartwarming or emotional or thrilling storylines. My first book, my debut novel, came out last year. It's called The Exit Strategy, and I just got the news last night that it won its fifth award, so I'm kind of celebrating on that. It's doing pretty well for a first novel. And I have a podcast called, like you say, The Best of Women's Fiction, which came out of a place where I wanted to use my own platform because I am starting to have quite a following. I've got about 7,000 followers on Instagram, and I wanted to use my own platform to uplift other authors who perhaps didn't have the visibility that I had, perhaps didn't yet have the readership or the following. And so I created the podcast as a way to highlight authors that I admire and respect. So I tried to pick people who I think are among the best in the genre. I get a lot of pitches that I actually have to turn down, and it's getting a little challenging at this point. I'm getting a lot of pitches, funnily, from publicists, which is not something I was expecting when I started the podcast. But it's fun because they're really short interviews. We keep them to 15 minutes max. And I ask, what is the inspiration behind the book? What is that germ of an idea that started this novel that just came out? Generally, we're talking about books that just released. I like to do the interviews and release them kind of the weekend after the book releases. And the reason I do that is it's really nice when if you hear an interview and you like a book, you can go buy it right away. And very often in writer world, what we do is this thing called pre-release campaigns where you can go buy the book, but it's not coming out for another 3, 4, 5 months. And so you go give your money to whoever your bookseller of preference is, and then you have to wait to actually read it. And maybe it's me. I'm an impatient person. So what I do with the podcast is I wait, even if we pre-record it, I wait and I release it right after the book is available so that if someone likes the story, they're inspired by the author, they can go download it and read it that very day. That's what I like to do. A little different than people who do things far in advance, but it works for me. And it's a lot of fun because I'm finding that people are coming to me now. It's kind of funny. I've actually seen some big time authors post recently, some really big bestsellers, like New York Times bestsellers. I just read this book, and I loved it. I just read it, and I found it from Lainey's podcast. And it's cracking me up that now people are like repeating back to me that they bought books and loved books because they heard them on the podcast.
That's awesome. And as the title says, it's fiction writers. It's not nonfiction. What was the choice, Mae? What was the thinking behind that? Was it because you're a fiction writer yourself with your book, or were you not interested in nonfiction?
It was, I love nonfiction books, but it was because that's the space I'm in. I'm writing women's fiction, and so I felt like I had a very good handle on that space. I know a lot of the authors. I've met many of them through the volunteer work that I do with an association called Women's Fiction Writers Association. So for me, it was like I know that space really well. I feel like I'm equipped to choose great authors. I love the nonfiction space. I love listening to nonfiction authors on Clubhouse these days. It's very fun to hear them talk about their books. I love nonfiction in audiobooks. Actually, when the author narrates their own book, I find that fabulous when it's nonfiction. I actually find in fiction, it's better if you get a professional narrator who's really able to perform it. It's more like acting when it's a fiction novel. A fiction novel, that's a, what do you call it when two words mean the same thing? See, I'm a writer. You're not supposed to ever say fiction novel because a novel by definition is fiction, but hey, whatever. So yeah, I love nonfiction, but I decided to focus the podcast on fiction just because that's the space I'm really familiar with. And gosh, the book world is so big to start with, right? You've got thousands of titles coming out every month that you kind of have to choose a focus of some type. Otherwise, it would be really overwhelming.
And you'd mentioned there, obviously, it's great. You're in some clubhouses at the moment that have the authors doing a reading. It's interesting you mentioned you should always, or you should get a professional, you know, voiceover person, I guess, to do the fictional stuff, because it kind of reminds me of I saw like a documentary on Disney Plus about the animation process and actors that are doing the voices for the animated characters are doing, and why. Sure, you could get anybody to give them voices, but if you bring in someone that does voiceover work anyway, like Mark Hamill is well known for his voiceover work for like the Batman's cartoons and stuff like that, but bringing in someone in, like, say, it just has that more nuance. They know when something needs to be emphasized or whatever, I guess, and makes it more enjoyable for the listener and helps the reader who would have been reading the books otherwise.
Yeah, especially because I believe the process when they're recording animation is they're doing the voice and then they're doing the animation to match, right? So like they're tweaking it, I believe, as they go these days, the way they do it. I'm not an expert, but I think that matters because that means the voice needs to portray the character completely, and then the animation needs to match that, as opposed to the other way around, that they are trying to match a cartoon that already exists. And so it's very similar when you're narrating a book. I actually just went through this process for the first time with my own debut novel. It just came out now, actually, in April, and I hired the narrator. She's called Susan Marlowe. She's done 150 books, and the process of creating that is fascinating. The first thing they do is they read your book end to end, and then they actually come back to you with a few questions. And then the next part is that, well, first, before all of that, they do auditions. So I actually listened to 50 different auditions from 50 different voice talent. And I picked this narrator because I really liked the way she was portraying my two characters differently to each other. And also she came really recommended from another author friend who said she was a pro. She was really easy to work with, which matters, right? If someone's great talent, but they're a pain in the ass to work with, that's going to be a problem. So I picked her for both of those reasons. And it was so fun to hear how it worked. So this was all new to me. They do a 15-minute, at least this was the way it worked with her. I think it's pretty standard. They do a 15-minute section of the book. So you choose which voices you want to hear. So in my case, I have two main characters in the book. The first one is a really powerful woman venture capitalist. And the second one is a CEO who's also a single mom. And it's very dramatic in the opening scenes. The powerful CEO has just discovered her husband is cheating. And she's about to walk into this meeting where she's going to sign a deal. She's investing in a company that she's bet her whole career on. And on the opening page, she realizes that the woman who owns this company is her husband's mistress. And so what really mattered to me is that the narrator got that these were two very different characters and portrayed them very differently so that you were never confused that my CEO mom, Carly, with a big case of imposter syndrome versus my powerful venture capitalist, I couldn't have the reader be confused about who was thinking and whose head we were in at any point in time. But also, I really wanted the tension to get across because the book is a page turner. Many people have told me the reviews, kind of the number one thing that turns up in reviews is people say it's a page turner. Well, you could mess with that in the audio format if you weren't careful, if you didn't get it right. So I wanted that same kind of tension. And so I picked a narrator who also does suspense novels. So she does thrillers and suspense as well as women's fiction. And I think that helped with her kind of getting that tension into it. And then the fun thing is, you don't hear it again until the whole thing is done. So they don't give it to you in sections. They really want to do the whole book. It is performing. It's acting that they're doing here. And so she did the entire book. And then I got 12 hours of audio to listen to. And you go back with what are called pickups, which is basically any little things that need change. So like a small word, you know, she said of instead of on, or a pronunciation of something, like a place that's a real place that's pronounced wrong. And so you go back with that, and then you fix those. And she really was a pro, because I think in a book of 12 hours of audio, we only had to fix like, I think it was like 10 or 15 things in total, which is almost nothing if you think about it. It's almost nothing. And the funnest part of the whole process for me as a writer, this is my first book, it's my debut novel, was you don't actually get to hear your book read by somebody else. Like, there's a common thing we say in the writer world, which is once you put your work into the world, it does not belong to you anymore. And if you think about this, every book you've ever read, you're reading through the lens of your own personal experience, right? So when I read any book, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, especially if I get triggered by a book, that's not really about the book. It's about me and my personal history and something that happened that makes certain topics trigger me. It's the same reason you can't take negative reviews too personally, because it just means your work triggered that person, which could be completely to do with their life experience, nothing to do with that book in particular. And so you kind of get used to this concept that people say once your work is in the world, you don't own it. It belongs to the reader. Everybody's reading from their own lens, their own life. But here's the fun thing is you never actually see that in action, right? I don't get to watch over someone's shoulder while they read my book, right? It's happening apart, right? I get to see the reviews at the end of the day and what their overall impression was, but I don't get to actually sit and hear someone else read my work. And so 12 hours of hearing how someone else interpreted this, which was not at all the way I said the words, the intonation, the way the phrases were said, it was different. It was entirely different. And yet it still worked. That was actually a really kind of pride moment, like, wow, I created the thing and here's someone else reading the thing. And even though it's not the way I imagined it, it's still cool. And so that was a kind of a big high so far in my author career, the first time I got to listen to those 12 hours of audio.
And I was going to ask about that, because you'd mentioned that you only had to do about 15 changes, 15 edits or 15, what's it, callbacks?
Pickups.
Pickups. So you only had to do about 15 pickups. So obviously you got this after agreeing the first time that you're going to send it over. You didn't get it back until it was finally finished, which must have been kind of nervous to start with, thinking, oh my grief, I'm going to have this huge amount of edits or, you know, pickups to ask for. So listening to it back then, you mentioned that obviously the voiceover artist did a great job in intonating some of the stuff that you hadn't maybe intended to be intonated that way. Was it like almost like an out-of-body experience and listening it back and thinking, this is a really good book, and not even thinking it was your book that was being read at the time?
It was. There were a couple of moments. Now, that makes me sound a little like humble bragging, but there were a couple of moments where I was like, huh, that really worked. Like, in a way that I hadn't, like, to me, it was like, okay. Like, I thought it worked, but it was okay. And then when I heard her read it and she was putting all the emphasis into it, which is possibly what every reader is doing in their head, I was like, oh, that actually worked better than I thought it did. Like I think we are our harshest critics of our own work. We were talking earlier before we started about editing, right? When you have to edit a podcast and how much work goes into that. And it's very similar, by the way, with audio for an audiobook. What the narrator charges you is per finished hour. The acronym is PFH, which says that they're charging you an hourly rate, but not for their hours of work, for the finished hour of audio. And I actually just interviewed my audio narrator, actually on my own podcast. I invited her last week. I said, come and talk to me. I'm going to interview you about the art of being an audio narrator. How did you get into it? What are the highs and the lows? What's difficult? What's easy? And she was sharing that for each hour of finished work, she has probably read the book 5 to 6 times for that hour. So for each hour of finished work. So the first time she reads it, then she's actually narrating it, then she's editing it, then she's editing it multiple times. And so, yeah, she said at least 5 times she's read that same hour of the book before she gets to a finished hour.
Wow, that's crazy. I know when I'm doing editing, it takes me about 2.5 times the amount of the finished product. So if the show is 30 minutes long, I'm editing for about two hours maybe. I don't know. So I couldn't imagine reading a book 5 or 6 times to get to the one record, and that's incredible. When's that episode out? We're all looking forward to listening to that one.
My one is out. The Exit Strategy is out now in April. It just came out. It's just getting out there this week, actually.
Awesome. I'll be looking out for that. Now, we mentioned at the start, your show, I think, premiered at the beginning of this year, but it actually started out as a video podcast. So what's the transition to audio been like for you?
Yeah, it's, you know, first thing I'll say is it's been a surprise how many people just love the podcast format. And like you said, I started on video. And the reason I did that was I was trying to leverage, like I said, my Instagram following. And so I thought the best way to do that is to do Instagram TV. So I did it as videos that I released on Instagram TV. And then just at the beginning of this year, I thought, you know, it wouldn't be that much more work to also make it into a podcast. I checked out Anchor FM and I discovered that you could take your video. I record the videos on StreamYard. You could take the video and upload it to Anchor FM and it'll strip out the audio. And then I would add like a header at the beginning. I would add some music, but it wasn't like a whole separate thing. It could be, you know, maybe 40% more work to also do it as a podcast as opposed to, you know, 400% more work. And so I did it as an experiment at the beginning. The first four podcasts I released, and I thought, let's see if anyone's even interested in this format. And it shocked me how excited everybody got about the fact that it was now a podcast. And all these people who are like, oh, I always wanted to watch the video, but I could never find time. And now I can listen to it while I'm doing my housework or while I'm taking my kids to, you know, their soccer practice, if you still get to go these days, or while I'm taking my kids somewhere in the car. And so it was fascinating to me, the excitement level that came over that. And also how much I started getting pitched and how many more people wanted to go be on the show now that it was a podcast. And so it's growing. I'd encourage people to check it out. It's really short, 15-minute episodes each. But and we've done a couple of special episodes. One was with my narrator, which was a little bit longer. It was 30 minutes because I wanted to do a full interview. And I actually included pieces of the audiobook as examples. So when she talks about how do you do different voices, I took a piece of the audiobook for 3 minutes after and actually put it into the podcast so people could hear an example, which I thought was kind of fun. So it made it more real to hear what she was talking about. And then I did a special episode, which is also 30 minutes long, where I took all the best advice from the first 30-odd authors who'd been on the podcast and on the videos. And I created one podcast episode that was just advice for aspiring writers. And it's really cool. There's a lot of great stuff in there. If you're ever thinking about getting into the writing profession or even doing it as a hobby, that one's the one I would definitely not miss. I wish I'd had all of that advice when I started out.
And that's a great thing you mentioned, Ella, about podcasts. You can put it basically in the background and do whatever you're doing. You can go up on the treadmill. You can go, maybe not golfing. I guess you could go golfing. I don't know. But it makes an easy buy-in to anybody. There's no technical, you know, buy-ins or anything. So it's really cool to hear that it's been picked up so well. And obviously your guests are all authors, hence the name of the podcast, the Best of Women's Fiction podcast. And you mentioned that you want to give a voice, you want to use your platforms to give a voice to authors that may not have a platform themselves. Is there obviously that's one of the processes. What's your process for picking who you'd like to have on as guests or who you'd like to interview for the podcast?
So in the beginning, it was very easy for me because I'm very well connected to the women's fiction writers community. I used to be the head of programs for WFWA, Women's Fiction Writers Association, which is an association of about 1,500 members, all of whom write women's fiction. And so in the beginning, it was easy because I would know most of these authors either through WFWA or I'm a host of a Facebook group where we have 10 author hosts called Blue Sky Book Chat. And so I would also hear about books through that and through our readers there as well. So in the beginning, it was easy because I was doing invite only. Like I was reaching out and inviting people. And it wasn't hard for me to think of who to invite because I would just see that, like, for example, Anne Garvin, who's an author I totally admire, her third book is coming out in May. So I would just send her a quick message, even on DM, and say, hey, Anne, saw you got a new one coming. Want to be on the show? It was that simple. And then I had a standard email that I sent that explained how it worked, that we recorded on StreamYard, that what they needed in order to do the recording. But it was a standard email. It went every time. And we just agree on a release weekend. And then we could record any time in advance. And then I got a bit more sophisticated recently where I'm using Calendly where people can pick their own schedule so that I don't have to get into the scheduling back and forth. But what's actually become really hard now is now that I'm getting pitched by books and authors that I don't know, I'm having to do more research in order to decide whether or not to say yes. And that's actually, I don't like that. I don't actually like being in the position of having to say no to somebody sometimes. But sometimes the book, you know, it doesn't have very many reviews yet. It's kind of hard to know. And I'm not going to have time to read every single book. I read a lot of books. I do a lot of blurbs to try and help my fellow authors. From time to time, I do beta reading, so I'll have seen the book even a year before it came out in an early form. But, you know, it's not realistic at this point. Like, someone just asked me if I could write them a blurb by the end of May, and I said, honestly, I have 15 books that I've committed to read and review by the end of May. I want to help you, but I'm not sure I can do it, like, physically time-wise. And so it's becoming a bit more of a challenge, because it used to be that if I wasn't sure about a book, I would just say, hey, send me a copy and I'll read it, and then I'll work out whether it fits. But now that's just more than I can commit to. So I have to look at, like, are they referred by an author I admire? So if Camille Pagan, who I adore, who's a fabulous best-selling author, says, this person should be on your podcast, I trust her instincts. She knows what she's talking about. She's a book coach. She wouldn't send me a book that isn't worthy and isn't really among the best. And so that's easy. So sometimes I'm having to do a little bit more GQ when people reach out to me. I actually have to go, like, okay, who do they have a blurb from? What a blurb is when your book is coming out, you reach out to other authors and you ask if they'll read it for you before it's in the world. And then they write, it's basically like an advance review by an author. And that's what you see, like when you see two sentences on the front of a book, or you see it on Amazon where it has some quotes right as the book comes out. That's before readers even got access to it. So that's going to be other authors. They're given an early copy. And so I'll look if it has a good blurb. If it's, you know, it's easy if it's an author I know and I admire and they're already a bestseller, that's easy. But like, I'll look at who's recommending them to me. I'll look at their blurbs. If they've won any awards or prizes already before the book came out, that one's a little trickier because there's not that many pre-publication awards. And sometimes I'll kind of say, like, the current situation, I just literally don't have any slots before September. Like, I am booked every weekend through September. In fact, I've got a short season break in there, which I'm trying valiantly to hold for 2 weeks so that I can take 2 weeks off. But other than that, like, I'm booked through mid-September right now. And so I've also gotten to the point where sometimes now I'm saying, like, listen, I'm booked through September. Check back with me in a few months. And in that way, I know their book's going to be out in a few months. Maybe I can see a little bit more about it than is out there yet. And maybe that'll give me a bit more information as well. So I'm not very good at saying no. I hate saying no to fellow authors. It makes me feel bad.
Yeah. But obviously, as you mentioned, it needs to fit in with your show and your goal, you know, with the guests to highlight the guests and give them more. Because I'd imagine if someone's already got a fairly large audience or they've got a whole host of awards behind them, it might be less of an attractive guest, for want of a better word. That was a terrible description. But less of an attractive guest for you to talk to maybe than an up-and-coming, or maybe just had one book out or something. Or is that not the case?
Oh, I love both. No, I love both. Authors like, so for example, I've had Carrie Lunsdale, who's a big bestseller on. I've had Barbara O'Neill, who sold, I think she sold 2 million copies through Lake Union Publishing. It's crazy. And the cool thing about these guests is, yes, they'll come on and they'll talk about the inspiration for their latest book. But what I love asking authors who are multi-time bestsellers, I'm about to talk to Bettley Crosby in the coming weeks, she's in that category too, is how do they keep having inspiration? It's one thing to have inspiration for one novel or two or three, but when you get to talk to someone who's had 10 plus best-selling million copy books, like, I want to know how the heck they keep doing that, because I want to do that like someday. And so I know a lot of my listeners are also writers and they're interested in, like, where does the inspiration keep coming from? You know, Barbara O'Neill shared some fascinating things around how she keeps newspaper clippings and her husband will like see something in the news that's like quirky or weird, like someone ran away to the circus, and he'll like snip it for her and send it to her for her file. And she just keeps like an inspiration file so that as she's working on one novel, all this stuff is brewing in her inspiration file for the next one. And then the other thing I love to ask authors who are further down the path is what their advice is for writers who are just starting out, who are many years behind them or a few years behind them. That's a question I ask every guest. And it is interesting how different the answers are from a new author whose first book is coming out. It's called a debut author, which is what I was last year, versus someone who's had many books. And I think one of the things readers don't realize, and even writers don't realize in writer world, is the authoring path is pretty up and down. It's a roller coaster. Even when you are a best-selling author, so there's a fabulous episode with Camille Pagan, who I referenced earlier, who's one of my favorite novelists, and there's a fabulous episode where she shares that now people know her as this best-selling author, but she shares that her debut when it came out was slammed in the reviews, like she wanted to crawl under the bed and die level of bad. And she brings this up to say, you assume when you look at her now, and she's this incredible best-selling author, and she's a book coach, and she's really well known, that that was like a seamless, flawless path. She's like, I almost gave up after book one. It was such a disaster for me. Like, I felt personally offended that everybody was saying they hated it. And it's not true that everybody was saying they hated it. It had, you know, varied reviews, but we take it really personally when our work is in the world and is criticized. And so I love talking to authors who are further in the path. And I'd encourage folks to listen to Camille's own words as she describes that. She does it much better justice than I am. But I love when people share that, the ups and downs of it, the why they keep going. Like Barbara O'Neill shared the idea that how do you find your voice? She has a very strong voice. One of the things people love about her books is when you read her book, you know it's a Barbara O'Neill book, and that's what's called having a voice as an author. And if you think about anything you love to read or to listen to, right, the personality that makes that person on the radio, that person or their podcast, that's the same thing. It's a voice, right? And so she said, the way you find your voice is you listen to what people say about your work and what people compliment about it. And that's your voice. Like, and then double down on it. So take that thing and do it even more, because that's you doubling down on your voice that people will appreciate.
So that's real interesting. And I really like that advice, because generally as human beings, we always look for the worst. And we always, if someone's speaking bad of us, we take that a lot more seriously than if someone's trying to pay us compliments. And I know my wife always tells me that I'm really bad at accepting compliments, and I need to work on that. And I do. I will admit that. I think that's a Scottish thing though, Lainey. I think that's our backgrounds.
Oh, totally. You
know, we don't take compliments too easily. But I love that advice. And especially, as you mentioned, as an author or a content creator, whether it's a podcaster, blogger, whatever, you're always going to have people. It is in public, so you have to have a kind of thick skin and know that they're on about what yes. you put out, as opposed to you yourself. And that advice about pick up on the things that they're praising you for, because that's who's actually you. I love that advice. And I'm guessing that's what you've taken into your corporate history, which we'll talk about soon, actually, moving into the book world, etc. So I'm guessing that's been a good primer for you.
Yeah, it has. You know, this book is interesting. My own book that just came out. And I was just talking to someone on an author podcast about author marketing, Dana Kay. She has a podcast called Your Breakout Book. And it's all about how to market your book as an author. And one of the questions she was asking me was, how did you know who your audience was? And I said, honestly, I didn't. Because this book is a bit unique. It's two women who are put in this dramatic situation, but ultimately it's a book about friendship, and it's a feminist book, and it's uplifting. But there was no other book that was quite like that in the world. And so normally when you're bringing out your book, what you look for is something called comps. It means comparable titles. And you say, okay, this book is really like that other book, so I'll do the same things for marketing that that other person did because it worked for them. And you also physically, like you actually compare. You say it's just like Twilight. If you loved Twilight, you will love this vampire novel too. Now, obviously, I couldn't do that. So what I did is when your book goes out into the world, first it becomes available for early review from readers, not just from authors, but there's a service called NetGalley where you can put your book up on NetGalley and people can get it for free before it's released in exchange for writing an honest review about the book. Now, you have to have a hard skin to go in and look at your NetGalley reviews before the book comes out, but I actually did go in and I read them from the lens, like you say, of who enjoyed this book. Who is this book for? Who read it and said, I love this to death? And those are the people I need to find more of, because those are my readers. And I found that women who appreciate female friendships, women who are professional women, anyone who's worked in an office environment, anyone who likes kind of a little bit of tension, but an ultimately happy story. But interestingly, I found that like thriller readers who read only pure thrillers were not digging this book, because it's not exactly that. It's about friendship, and it's a bit more touchy-feely by the end of the book than a pure thriller, right? Like, the husband who betrayed them both does not die during the book. You would want him dead if it was a thriller, and you'd want them both to make him dead. And so it was just really helpful as a way, you got to put on your armor, your emotional armor, but a way to say, like, who is this book for? Because I didn't have an easy way to tell that before it came out. And so I think that might be my startup background, that it's okay to just try something and see what happens and then learn and then go from there.
Now, you mentioned your startup background, and obviously your book, The Exit Strategy, is set in the tech world around the high-flying executives of that world, which is your own story. You're a high-flying tech executive yourself. So how much of the book is pulled from your own life in the tech industry?
This is one of my favorite questions. I worked in Silicon Valley and I worked for really big tech companies. I worked for a multi-billion dollar, almost $100 billion tech company managing billion dollar divisions. And then I also worked for startups, creating the whole company, getting the marketing team off the ground as a chief marketing officer. And I did that for 20 years. And then after 20 years, I was pretty burned out. It is frustrating and tiring to be the only woman in the room and to be the only senior woman on the team. Like after a while, it starts to really wear you down. And so I decided to take 6 months. I just finished at one startup. And normally you kind of roll straight into the next one. The minute you leave, headhunters are calling you and you're working out where you're going next. And I decided to give myself 6 months to see if I had an ending to this book. I actually didn't know. I had a beginning. I had a very clear picture of how the book started with this wife and a mistress who are forced to work together, but I didn't know where it ended. And so I gave myself 6 months to write the first draft. Now, anyone who's close to writing world knows we call it a shitty first draft for a reason. The first draft is just that. I love the phrase that says you're just pouring sand into the sandbox. That's the goal of a first draft, is to give yourself something to work with and editing. The real beauty of words and writing actually happens in revision as you revise it many times before it comes out. But I gave myself 6 months because I didn't even know if I had the end of this story. And I didn't know if this was really going to be my gig. And was I willing to step back from a good paying job in tech? You know, writers don't make very much money, to do this instead. And what happened is I gave it 6 months. And after 6 months, I found out I did know the ending. And I wanted to give the book a chance to actually see the world. So then I give myself another 6 months. And my husband and I realized, well, if I'm not earning any money while I'm writing before it comes out, why are we still living in San Francisco? Why are we still paying rent at crazy San Francisco rental prices? And he's a tech guy, and he realized that he could do his job from anywhere. He does consulting and tech development for various companies. And so that was what drove us into becoming nomads. We realized we could live in the most beautiful places in the world, so long as they had Wi-Fi, for, you know, a tenth of the price of what it would cost us to be in San Francisco. And depends on your places. Like sometimes it's not a tenth, sometimes it's a half. But, you know, we avoid expensive cities. Like we've never spent significant time in London or Paris because that would kind of defy the point. It would be like being in San Francisco. But we've lived in Cartagena, Colombia, which is fabulous. I thoroughly recommend it. We've been in and out of many locations in Mexico. Right now I'm in San Miguel de Allende, where we actually now have a house that we're going to rent part-time and come to part-time. By October, we're hoping to be in New Orleans. We actually just preliminarily booked ourselves an Airbnb in October for the full month in New Orleans. If anyone's looking for a travel recommendation, and obviously you can't make two concrete plans right now because we don't know what's going to happen with the world, but I'm kind of crossing my fingers that enough of us will be vaccinated, including myself, that by October we'll be able to be a little bit more open. And all of the fun things that happen in New Orleans during the year, like Jazz Fest, like French Quarter Festival, there's another one that's a big electronic music festival. There are four big festivals that happen over the year, and they've all moved to October. So in 1 month, you get like a year of New Orleans festivals. Pretty much everything but Mardi Gras is preliminarily booked for October. And so if it goes ahead, it's going to be a pretty fun, lovely month to visit. And the thing about being a digital nomad for us is we work full time. We're not traveling to be on vacation, right? We're both working a full time schedule. So even if none of those things happen, so long as it's safe to be in an Airbnb and walk around the streets, we'll still be able to walk around and buy beignets and drink coffee and enjoy walking around New Orleans, even if none of the festivals happen.
Now, you mentioned that in your career, you were the only high-flying woman executive in your industry. And we've seen in recent years, with the Me Too movement especially, that the tech industry can be a very sexist and toxic place. You were in the industry for a while, and I was wondering, with the reputation it has, especially in San Francisco, did you encounter any of this toxicity in your own experiences?
Oh, yeah. I didn't thoroughly answer your question. I'm going to actually answer your question from before in answer to this. You had asked, you know, how much of the book was inspired by real life and how did I get to the story? And what happened is the inspiration was the wife and the mistress story. And then I asked myself, well, where am I going to set this? So if I have this wife and this mistress who are forced to work together, where am I going to set that story? And what's the scenario where they're forced to work together? And the obvious answer for me, coming from having worked in Silicon Valley for 20 years, is I'll just set it in Silicon Valley. I'll set it in the world I'm used to, where you've got startups and you've got venture capitalists investing in those startups. So that was the easy choice. The sexism, and it's really funny because this book has been called a feminist anthem. The sexism, I actually didn't set out to write into the book. I just said it in what I was used to and wrote the story of what that world looks like. I wanted to show people what it felt like to be in that world, to be the only woman in the boardroom. And the sexism is just part of what I experienced through my entire career. And so I actually wrote an author's note at the end, because my own mother, interestingly, I didn't let her read it until it was final and it was actually done with copy edits. And then I let her read it because my mother is super critical. She is the most critical person I know. She is an ex-English lecturer, to give you an idea. And I knew that she was going to pick it apart. And I wasn't mentally able to deal with that. I just knew that I wouldn't be able to have my own mother pick my work apart until it was like done. And I felt like it was as good as it could be. But when she read it, my mother says to me, "So all that stuff about the sexism and the main character, the head of the venture capital firm, who they ultimately have to work out how to take down together, like, you made all that up. That's fiction, right?" And I actually had to explain to my own mother that not a word of that was made up. In fact, the author's note says that I toned it down. I significantly toned down the sexism in the book because I felt like for people who didn't live in that world, it wasn't going to be credible. And I actually mention in the author's note that there's an example of something that I experienced frequently in tech, which is meetings happening at strip clubs, where the guys, we've been in a meeting all afternoon and they say, "Let's take this meeting to the strip club." And you're faced with this horrible decision as a woman of like, you're either going to say, you know, no, hell no, in which case you're that person and now you're like out of it because they're going to go anyway. So now you're out of the meeting. Or you're going to go and have the most awkward business meeting in the history of reality where some woman is wiggling her tits and ass over you while you're trying to have a business conversation. Or you're kind of going to make a joke of it and try to be one of the guys, but not kind of, it's horrible. It's just a horrible, horrible situation because there's no good answer in that scenario other than don't do it. Don't suggest it. It's a stupid idea. But that was an example of something I took out of the book because I just thought people are not going to believe that actually happens, even though it happened to me 4 or 5 times over my career.
Wow. What do you think needs to change? As someone who's been in the industry at a high level and seen the experience you just mentioned there, for example, what needs to be done to encourage diversity and equality, especially in the tech industry, which has always come across as, you know, Silicon Valley frat boys continue to act the way they probably did in college?
Yeah, there's a whole bro culture. If you just Google like BRO, Silicon Valley, all these terms around it as well. And it's interesting because I think people who went to certain types of universities and came out of a certain frat boy culture used to go into like the capital finance industries of the world. They'd go to Wall Street, right? And you got kind of that real bro frat boy culture on Wall Street. And then something happened about 10, 15 years ago where those same people graduating were going into tech instead because it was viewed as being where the big money, big upside was. And so it made it worse, in my opinion, because a certain type of person who was gravitating towards a certain type of life where it was all about the money you could make out of it, and it kind of made it worse. You saw it in the gaming industry as well. It got really ugly, and it still is really ugly in gaming. The simple answer to this, and if I knew like a silver bullet to make this happen easily, I would tell you, the simple answer is we need teams that look like the diversity of the world we live in. So we need a team. When we have a team, and that includes a senior team of a startup, you know, there should not be one woman on the board, right? We don't live in a world where out of a board of 10 people, one woman, so 10% of the world is not women, right? 50% of the board should be women. And having one woman on a board actually puts a horrible burden on that one woman where she's not only speaking for herself, she's speaking for all of womankind, and she's playing the role of being the woman on the board in addition to being herself and succeeding as herself. So there's like a double burden on that woman. And it's the same thing if you're the only Black person on the board, if you're the only person of Indian descent, if you're the only transgender person on the board, like pick any category. If there's only one, you then have to play a double role of representing your group in addition to actually doing your job. So you're having to kind of almost like twice the work and represent yourself differently as a woman. You're having to I talk about this a lot with other career women. You're having to manage how you're perceived as a woman and how your emotions are perceived, in addition to actually getting across your point that you want to make in the meeting. So, you know, if a man finds that something has happened where, you know, the company did something terrible, right? Like we lied on an application form. The guy gets to slam his fist on the desk and say, "Unacceptable. We do not do that in this company ever." And the whole team sits up, pays attention, and they go, "He's angry. This is really bad what we did." If a woman does the same thing and slams her hand on the table and says, "This is unacceptable," everybody goes, "Whoa, she's kind of hysterical today." And you get perceived entirely differently. And your anger is perceived differently. It's not perceived as a productive thing. And so you're constantly managing how you express your emotions, which is not necessarily the way you would naturally express them. And again, that's a double burden. So you're like, you're representing womankind, you're trying to do your job, and you're managing how your emotions are perceived in the meeting. Gosh, it's tiring. And I think it's tiring for any group that is not represented at minimum, at an equal level to what they represent in society. I mean, if you look at African Americans, there are so few in tech. It's ridiculous how often you will have an entire tech company of 100 people and not one African American on the entire team. And so, like, you know, one would be one in 100 is 1%. It's 10% of the population in the US. So why is it not 10% of the population in our companies? Like, and I know it's not easy to solve, but that's what we should be shooting for, is for teams that look like the world we live in terms of the diversity of them. And we're very, very far from that right now.
It reminds me of a panel I saw, which I can't remember where it was, if it was like South by Southwest or Social Media World or something. And it was about the importance of gender equality when it came to representation, pay, etc. And it was an all-male panel. So it rightly got slated on social media, with people decrying a panel about gender equality being an all-male one. I mean, everyone's thinking, are you crazy? Why would you do this?
There's a line in the book where the head of the venture capital firm that Rin, my main character, works for, is called Simon Atherton in the book. And he's kind of that bro culture very much, but he's a little older, right? He should know better. For sure. You know, he's in his 40s, but he's got that whole bro culture thing. And there's a line in the book where he says, "I'm not sure women have the balls to make good business decisions." Or maybe it's the same thing. Like, there's a line in the book where he refers to balls. And I had the number of business meetings that I have been in over my career. I mean, like, we're into the thousands, where having the balls is used as a way to say courage. Well, nobody stops and thinks about, like, what does that mean to the other people in the room when you say it that way? And so I deliberately put that in the book, and it's actually the way I wrote it in the book is almost word for word what I had heard many times from someone who specifically was in my head as someone I had worked with when I wrote that. And just to say that, like, I write under a pen name. Like, Lainey Cameron is my pen name. It's also how most people know me these days. But it was a little deliberate, in that I didn't want to end up one day, if I went back to my job in Silicon Valley, sitting across the interview table from a CEO where I'm supposed to be interviewing for their job as their best advisor, as their chief strategist and marketing officer. And they look at me across the table and go, "So let me get this right. You write about people like me in your books?"
Now, you'd mentioned earlier that you and your husband are now digital nomads and working while traveling the world. And it sounds like you've had some amazing adventures. One that stood out for me when I read it was a certain hunting trip in Tanzania with stoned tribesmen. How did that come about?
So, funnily, that was before we became digital nomads. We actually took, and this was part of what inspired us to do the nomadic thing, is back when we were both working in tech, I think about 3 years before we truly started becoming nomads, we took a 6-month sabbatical. And my husband kept working the whole time for that 6 months. I actually took a sabbatical from my startup because it was going to be too hard for me to do my kind of job remotely. And so we took 6 months, and we did that differently. We actually moved around a lot. I think we covered like 20 plus countries in 6 months. And we were working, so we were doing like 2 weeks at a time. In fact, that's exactly how it adds up. It was like 2 weeks at a time for 6 months. You end up with like 20 odd countries. And so one of the places we went to was Tanzania. And we were on a safari for 2 weeks. This was the time where we actually did have to stop working. Like, you can't be on a safari in the middle of the Serengeti and assume you can get a Wi-Fi signal. Even though you could get a cell phone signal, I was amazed that the safari drivers in the middle of the Serengeti had cell phone signal the entire time. They were all calling each other, asking where the animals were. I saw some lions over here. Where are you? Where are you? Oh, I got some over here. So, like, I was amazed that they had cell phone signal in the middle of, like, literally the plains of the Serengeti. There's nothing for 100 miles, but we had cell phone signal. And what happened is we hired this local company to do our safari. This is a good tip if you're ever looking to go to a country that has very expensive safaris. So safaris can be ridiculously expensive. They can be like $20,000-$25,000 per person. Like, they can be crazyville. But we'd also read all these forums online that said, if you book directly with a local company and you pay them directly, it'll be like 10x cheaper than if you're going through a big international company that's marking it up. So the first scary piece of that is we actually found this company that was recommended from people on this travel forum, and we wired them the money. So we had no idea when we arrived at the airport in Tanzania whether anyone was going to turn up, because we were pretty dubious that, like, wiring money to this random account in Africa and maybe someone's going to turn up and take us on safari. And it was like, we're going to take the risk and we'll find out. Worst case, we'll get to Tanzania, we'll be in the airport, and no one will come get us, and we'll come up with a plan B. So we took the risk. They pick us up in this beautiful, well, not beautiful, but big 10-person safari truck. And so we're like, oh, cool. We're going to meet the rest of our safari. We go to the hotel. The next morning we get up, we're ready to leave. And first off, they laughed at us because they wanted to know where our bags were. And we're like, well, that little carry-on suitcase, that's it. That's our bag. And they couldn't believe we'd come on safari with a carry-on suitcase. We're traveling the world for 6 months. That's all we had, was a carry-on suitcase and a backpack with our laptop in it. And they take us off. And as we're leaving, we say, so where are the rest of the people for this 10-person truck? And they go, don't you know that you booked a private safari for 2 weeks? And so it was so cheap that we assumed there would be people in the truck with us. But the cool thing that happened is, because we were the only ones in this safari for 2 weeks, our driver was this amazing guy, Emmanuel, who had done all these documentaries for the BBC. And you can only see so many animals before you're like, okay, that's very interesting. More animals today. And he actually proposed that we go and do this thing with this tribesman. He said, the last tribe that is truly a hunter-gatherer nomadic tribe is in this area. I actually know them because I filmed this documentary about them through the BBC. And if we take them a bunch of pot, they will take you hunting for the day. And think about it, they're a true hunter-gatherer tribe. So they don't want electronics, they don't want money, they have no value in money, but they will take pot because they are stoned out of their minds. And so we go and they take us hunting, but before the hunting, there is like an hour ceremony where everybody is smoking. And it goes on and on and on. And it was just a very unique experience. I'm sure I got a contact high because, like, it was like we're sitting right there in the circle with them and we're smoking and smoking and smoking. And then after they're done smoking for an hour, they actually send off, like, the teenagers to go hunting. The guys were like, that's the tourists. Take the teenagers. So, like, these teenage boys between, like, 18 and 17 take us hunting with spears where they're tracking through the undergrowth. And, you know, you got to be quiet. Otherwise, if you crackle things, the animals hear us. And it was quite the experience going hunting with a bunch of stoned teenagers who also don't wear clothes yet because they don't have much use for clothes as hunting-gathering tribes either. So a bunch of stoned naked teenagers in the middle of the forest in Tanzania. It was an awesome, fun, unique experience. And here's what's both interesting and a little sad, but I think sad is judgmental here. The government in Tanzania wants to force the kids to go to school. So in these hunt, this is the last of the hunting gathering tribes. They were about 5 miles from the closest school. And the government wants to force the kids to go to school for good reason. The government wants the kids to have a chance in life, to have a choice. But if you think about it, once this generation of kids goes to school, they're not going back to being hunter-gatherers, right? Like, why would you go to school, see all the other kids with cell phones, see all the people with jobs and houses, and then choose to go back and hunt with a spear all day? Like, it's probably not going to happen. And so what Emmanuel, our driver, was explaining is you probably won't see this in 10, 15 years anymore. It's not going to exist anymore.
It's an interesting quandary, as you say. I mean, how involved do we as the developed world get? And is there a negative connotation to that involvement when you share an example like these kids?
Yeah, but on the other hand, like, are you going to deny those kids a chance at everything that all the other kids get? Like, it's a hard one, right? That's not an easy answer either way.
Now, I'd mentioned earlier that your show started at the beginning of the year and has adapted to become both a video and audio show. So what's your goals for the future of the podcast? And will you remain on both mediums or maybe concentrate on one over the other or something different?
It's a great question. I think I might need to ask people how much they like the videos versus the audio, because it's rapidly getting to the point that I'm getting more listens on the audio than views on the video. And so, you know, it's funny because when I started it, I thought I'll give the podcast a try for a few months. And if it doesn't take off, I'll just go back to doing just the videos because it's extra work. And now I'm like, oh, the podcast is actually taking off even faster than the videos. So I don't know. It's really interesting. I mean, I'm recording on StreamYard, so we're doing the video at the same time. I could just do a shorter video that's just a trailer for the podcast. I think I need to ask the people who are watching and listening and see what they think. I think I'm going to keep going with it. One of the things that is really interesting as an author is they say that you should try and bring out books fast. And the reason for that is people forget about you, right? You bring out your first book. My debut came out last year. It's still getting a lot of good PR because it's winning all these awards right now because the awards come out the following year. But by the time awards season is over this year, it'll kind of ride off into the sunset. It'll have, you know, a few sales, but it won't be a big buzz anymore. And so they say that you're supposed to bring out your next book a year after your first one. Well, very few authors actually churn out a book a year. It's hard, right? And you, if you put yourself on that kind of schedule, it's stressful as well because it's a huge work to revise a book. I mean, my first book took me 5 years and it must have been revised 15 times, as in rewritten 15 times by the time it came out. And so I'm working on the second one right now. I'm really excited about it. Maybe it'll be in 2022. So it'll have been, you know, a year and a half, 2 years from the first one. The really cool thing for the podcast for me is I can stay in front of readers and offer them value that is not me coming out with a new book. Because readers read voraciously. They love lots of books, right? One of the biggest fiction in the creative world is the concept of scarcity, or that we're competing with each other. We are not competing with each other, right? My podcast does not compete with your podcast. People can listen to both. And the same thing in writer world. My book does not compete with someone else's book. In fact, it's the opposite, that if I recommend a book, someone who's looking for something to read is going to read both, most likely. And so I love the idea that I'm going to have something that I can keep adding value to other writers and readers, even when I don't have a book coming out myself. And it's a way for me to kind of stay in their awareness, even though I don't have a book right now. And it takes a long time to bring a book out. And so for me, it seems like a really positive way. And it's taking a little bit of the pressure off me to bring out another book fast, which is nice because it is very stressful trying to like go through that entire process of writing the book and revising it. And when is it ready? When is it actually ready to see the world is one of the biggest, most challenging questions.
And for this new book, will you also be using a voiceover artist again to read it? Perhaps the same one as Exit Strategy?
Oh, that's a great question. My second book is a different age group. My main character in my second group is in her 20s, and she's actually a digital nomad. You know, all fiction is inspired from some version of real life. So my character in my second book is a digital nomad who is an adventure travel writer. So imagine those people you see, those amazing photos on Instagram, like hanging off the cliff by their fingernails, and they're like hanging there. So she's that kind of big adventure travel, skydiving, all kinds of stuff. But she has a dark past that she is afraid is going to catch up with her. She's living under a new identity. And so I think I would have to have my narrator audition for that and see if she's able to do it, because a 20-year-old character, 26-year-old, is pretty different to a 30 or 40-year-old character. And I know she said she's not a fan of doing like ingenue characters. So I need to let her have a go and see if it's something that she gets inspired by as well. Because you also want the narrator to be really excited about narrating that character and feel like they can give it all their best as well.
It's awesome. So Lani, I really enjoyed chatting with you today. For listeners who want to check out your podcast, buy your book, or perhaps connect with you online, where's the best place to do that?
I'm going to give you two web addresses. So to buy my book, as in my author persona, that's going to be my website, which is laineycameron.com, L-A-I-N-E-Y, Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N.com. Good Scottish name there. Actually, my grandmother's maiden name is how I picked my pen name. And if you want to check out the podcast, it has its own website. It's bestofwomensfiction.com. And you can find the links right there on bestofwomensfiction.com, both to the video versions. And it's on Apple. It's on Google Podcasts. It's on Stitcher. It's on Spotify, Anchor FM. But all of the links are right there on the website.
And I'll be sure to leave the links to all of these in the show notes. So if you're listening on your favorite podcast app, make sure to check the show notes as usual. So thanks again, Lainey. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks, Danny. This has been so fun. I really appreciate that you've invited me. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Podcaster Stories. If you enjoyed this week's episode, head on over to podcasterstories.com where you can catch up on the previous episodes as well as sign up to the free newsletter. You can also find the show on your favourite podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher and more. Until the next time, take care and stay safe.